Today at Reader's Corner, Greg Mitchell, author of The Tunnels, escapes under the Berlin Wall and the historic films that the JFK White House tried to kill. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. In 1961, the world watched as tensions flared and the Berlin Wall went up, trapping East Germans inside a communist regime. What was less well known was what was happening under that wall. Away from the glare of television cameras and public demonstrations, defectors and West Germans engaged in clandestine efforts to build tunnels and help East Germans escape. In his book, The Tunnels, Escapes Under the Berlin Wall and the Historic Films That the JFK White House Tried to Kill, Greg Mitchell takes us inside those tunnels and introduces us to the heroes who risked their lives for their families, friends, and even strangers. He also sheds new light on the relationship between President John F. Kennedy and the news media that was desperately trying to capture and show the tunneling efforts. The Tunnels is now out in paperback. On this Thanksgiving weekend, we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Greg Mitchell. He is the author of more than a dozen books, including The Campaign of the Century, which won the Goldsmith Book Prize and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Greg Mitchell, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Very happy to be there. Thank you.
What was going on in Germany in the 1950s and early 60s that would give the East Germans this motivation to build the wall?
Well, the primary thing was that there had been a massive outflow of citizens from East Germany to West Germany throughout the 1950s. A tremendous percentage of the population had, well, I don't even say emigrated to the West, fled the communist Soviet-dominated East Germany and East Berlin and made it to the West. It wasn't that difficult then, because people would probably surprise many people to know that just concentrating on Berlin for a moment, there was a tens of thousands of people passed from East Berlin to West Berlin every day were allowed to pass legally through checkpoints to attend college and to perform jobs in the West, and then they were like commuters. Controls were tightened over time, but still, subways were connected east to west, phone lines, and so forth. So, and of course, what happened was so many of these people then would go to the West and stay there, and this was a very embarrassing for the East. There was a brain drain. They were losing skilled workers, academics, the whole range. So that was the primary reason why the wall suddenly emerged in August of 1961.
Mm-hmm. So the wall was 25 miles long, and I'm just wondering, again, my geography naivete on this one, so what happens when you get to the 26th mile? Can you just walk around it?
Well, I guess what needs to be clear, and I can't say I was 100% clear when I started this project a few years ago, but Berlin is actually in the middle of East Germany. So you have the old country of Germany divided more or less down the center, and Berlin was not at the center. Berlin is located far in the east. So you had this island of Berlin, swimming in the middle of the communist East Germany. So the wall was needed to basically encircle. I think, the image that most people have is this wall down the center of a city. But actually, it had to encircle West Berlin so that people all around East Germany could not enter West Berlin from the many, mm-hmm. many different ways they may have had to do it. Hence, the fencing went up, the wall went up, and the only way, besides trying to climb the wall and get shot, to get from East Berlin to West Berlin was to go under the wall through tunnels, and that's sort of what the book is about.
Right. Well, do we know how many people were killed trying to escape, whether it's over the wall or under the wall by tunnel?
Well, by tunnel, there weren't that many that died. There were some who died. There were escape helpers who died. There, tunnelers themselves who died. It wasn't that large a number. There were far more shot at the wall. There were, several hundred shot at the wall, trying to climb the wall, break through the wall, go over in balloons even. Swim canals was very popular. Very many died in those sorts of attempts. Underground, of course, fewer, there's only so many tunnels and only so many people who would risk going into a dark tunnel several hundred feet under the wall. But yes, there were escapees and tunnelers, and even a couple East German guards who were shot and killed.
How many tunnels were there? And I guess we could break that down into how many tunnels actually worked and how many tunnels failed because of water issues or cave-ins or whatever.
Well, it's hard. People have tried to do lists. The number of tunnels that they sort of really got going and were, you know, mainly finished would be several dozen. Of those, maybe one-third or one-fifth actually hosted escapes, where it got as far as, okay, this tunnel is completed, more or less, and we're going to try to get people through it. So in most cases, as you point out, tunnels fell apart, or the East Germans threw grenades and blew them up. Water was always a threat. So most of them did not work. And the ones that worked, you know, some worked spectacularly, and others, they only got three or four people through.
I've been down in a coal mine before, and I saw one photo. It was a very sophisticated tunnel. I remember the movie Der Tunnel, and watching that, my recollection, and boy, it's a long while ago, but my recollection is that, you know, they were on their bellies crawling in this little bitty space.
Yeah.
But then I saw another one that looked like you. In fact, they weren't they actually carrying dirt out in these large carts?
Yeah.
The tunnel was big enough to do that, right?
Yeah, well, they had to get, no matter how you dug a tunnel, you had to get the dirt out. And, you know, the really claustrophobic ones, they simply put the dirt in pans and then pulled the pans out with ropes. The ones that were bigger, and really the biggest ones, the best you could do is crouch. You know, they were basically 4 by 4 feet, more or less. So you could crouch and walk through and work. And some of them did have actual carts on a rail, like a rail line of sorts. And they could load up a cart and then pull it back to the end of the tunnel. But, you know, my book focuses on it's really almost completely about 1962, which was the second year of the wall. And it was the year of the most tunnels. It was the year of the most spectacular escapes, the most spectacular shootings at the wall. It was the year of the highest U.S.-Soviet tension. It was the year after Kennedy's Bay of Pigs and just before the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I think what gives the book a lot of the narrative, which, you know, people have really praised, the driving, riveting narrative, is because it really only covers about 10 months of that year. And you're getting all these developments from around the world of the U.S.-Soviet tensions, nuclear buildup, and then, of course, the media exploitation or the media joining in on things. So it's really kind of a very up-close look. It's not the entire history of the Berlin Wall or the Cold War or anything like that, but it's you know, it's a very dynamic look at what I would call the most significant slice of it.
In that particular year then of 1962, do we know an approximate number of how many people did escape using those tunnels?
Well, again, you can't be sure. I think even just in that year, there weren't more than 200. I chronicle some of them in the book. You know, there's 30 here. There's 29 there. There's, you know, a 16 there. So it adds up certainly to less than 200.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's really interesting about your book is that this book probably couldn't have been written the way you've written it 10 years ago, I gather, given the fact that so much information about this particular period has been declassified. Help us understand what you learned from all of these declassified CIA files, Department of State, FBI, whoever was involved. What is it specifically that you were able to uncover here that until then we didn't know a thing about? And by the way, one of them that I learned that I didn't know anything about was this: U.S. officials had reason to like the wall, as it turns out. Again, I grew up, I was going to college when 61 came along.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't remember anything about U.S. officials liking the wall.
Yeah.
It was all about how horrible it was that we've placed a wall between authoritarian government and democracy.
Right. Well, I wouldn't use the word liking.
I'd
say more like accepting.
Right.
You know, the truth was that the U.S., while based on our principles and freedom and everything else, were sympathetic to people in East Germany and other communist states. There was only so far we would go to stick our necks up out. People have the idea that the U.S. would have, you know, really tried and did everything they could to prevent the wall, bring down the wall, or help people escape. And none of that was true, because what the U.S. feared was a conflict with the Soviets, nuclear or otherwise. And Berlin was the flashpoint in the world at that point. And so, you know, as the book chronicles, you know, when the wall went up, Kennedy had a famous quote, you know, a wall is better than a war, which, you know, kind of encapsulates it. Mm-hmm. And other people in the administration, Kennedy himself, basically advised, let's, you know, do nothing, say nothing and do nothing. And there was some sense of welcoming it because it ended, you know, the fear was that the Soviets were going to invade. The fear was that this mass immigration was going to, you know, cause a real war. And the wall went up kind of solved a lot of problems. It stopped the immigration. And, you know, it now seemed like the Soviets were just going to retrench in East Berlin and not have designs on West Berlin. So that's a little bit of it. And far as other documents, just to stick on one area here is the, you know, you mentioned the probably the other, say the other half of the book or a third of the book really concerns the media coverage of these tunnels and the White House attempt, and in one case, successful suppression of these films by CBS and NBC. And this was, you know, this fact that they tried to suppress these two films was, you know, was kind of slightly known. But what I got was all, you know, hundreds, or I guess thousands of documents showing how it happened, how the White House and the State Department, again, in a day-by-day fashion, learned about the tunnels and then tried to keep them off the air. And it's, you know, it's as blatant as can be because, it's, you know, it's cables back and forth from Berlin and Germany to Secretary of State Dean Rusk. It's, you know, meetings between Rusk and Kennedy's aides with CBS and NBC executives trying to force them to keep these films off the air. And so that's the real, I mean, there's many other declassified and important documents that I got, but some of the most interesting pertain to this real tick-tock on how this suppression happened from, you know, documents at the time, not something I'm kind of spinning from what one or two people might have remembered.
Well, the networks were actually involved in the filming of the tunnel projects, not just filming, but financing. I think I learned in your book that really, yeah, that's another one of those discoveries where I thought, really, now there's something I didn't learn on the Walter Cronkite, yeah, CBS Evening News.
Yeah, well, checkbook journalism goes way back. Now, in this case, I mean, the two tunnels are what I call the CBS tunnel and the NBC tunnel. The CBS tunnel was the legendary Daniel Shore of CBS and later NPR fame.
Right.
Was trying to get the first big scoop of filming a tunnel and a tunnel escape. And in that case, CBS kind of financed this tunnel when after it was pretty much already completed. So while they did give money to the diggers, the organizers, and you could say they partly financed it, it was shut down before they got much further with it. The NBC tunnel was financed by NBC for tens of thousands of dollars. Again, that tunnel had already started, but it had kind of barely started. And you could say that NBC money made the completion of the tunnel possible in purchasing equipment and right down to food and drink. So you could say that NBC was played a key role in that tunnel. And of course, they filmed the project all along. And, you know, as the book shows, the, you know, the CBS tunnel was shut down by the White House. The NBC tunnel, the White House did not know about until after the filming was completed, the escape happened, and the program was scheduled. They announced it was going to air, and it was then that the White House and State Department went into action to try to suppress it, and again, in fact, succeeded for several weeks.
Could you give us a little background on just how that happened, how the White House was able to suppress the networks in this effort?
Yeah. Well, back then, even more than today, much more than today in most cases, people in power, particularly the White House, was pretty cozy relationships with the heads of networks. I think you could say today we saw that with Roger Ailes at Fox with, you know, Republicans in the White House. Mm-hmm. But even if people think that some of the other networks have a certain liberal bias, their presidents and CEOs are not really hanging out and partying with the president.
Right.
But back then, I mean, everyone wanted to party with JFK, right? So back then, more than today, it was very common for network people to be really hobnobbing with whoever was in the White House, and particularly in the case of JFK, one might say. It just happened that one of his old Harvard roommates and good friends was the news director at CBS, and he was encouraged, you might say pressured, to bring the pressure on Daniel Shore at CBS, which he did. And Daniel Shore had no choice but to scuttle his own project. So in the case of NBC, there wasn't as direct a relationship with the White House. But nevertheless, the same thing happened. The NBC program was put on hold. It seemed like it was killed. And it only kind of surfaced weeks later, kind of quietly, and then went on to become... So you might say one of the most honored programs in the history of television, the only documentary to ever win the Emmy as the program of the year, all categories. So, it's quite a dramatic story on how particularly that film came to be, and then how it came to become legendary despite all this opposition.
Well, the Kennedy presidency has been redefined and rediscovered so many times, but it looks like you've done it one more time, because it almost seems as though you're talking about Nixon instead of Kennedy regarding...
Well, as I do in the book, I think the book is very balanced in the sense that just when you think that, Kennedy's showing no sympathy or trying to knock down these things, then you get the context, of the Cold War and the Soviet threat and U.S. interest and everything else. So you can leave it to the reader. I think some readers will read this and say, well, it's unfortunate some of the things Kennedy did, but it's understandable in the context of the times. So others would read it and say, come on, it was all balderdash. So I think that's a good aspect of the book. I think the Nixon... More directly Nixonian was that, as the book shows, was this Kennedy feud with the media, Kennedy hatred of much of the media. I think today we think that Kennedy was a real darling in coverage because, he got his wife got a lot of great coverage and so on and so forth. But actually, he hated the media as much as any president. In fact, ordered the FBI to bug a famous New York Times reporter, took steps to have the CIA monitor reporters, which this was before Nixon did it years later. So particularly in the media aspect, you might say there are certain Nixonian elements to Kennedy.
This does raise the issue of how we learn about history and at what point we learn the lessons of history. In this particular case, you seem to be the first guy out of the gate when it comes to using this declassified information to explain one particular aspect of the JFK presidency that we really didn't know about. Is it fair to say that historians will follow your lead here? And in the next few years, we might be able to know for sure whether there was really any reason why Kennedy feared the major shooting incident might be sparked by an escape operation, so therefore the wall wasn't such a bad idea. I mean, it looks like you're really the first person to nail this, but I suspect people are going to come after you.
Well, again, this isn't a shot out of the blue. There have been Kennedy biographies that have noted the ambivalence. I think I use documents and, again, context, and then going into the following year, a lot of the stories about the wall, particularly with Kennedy, sort of start and end in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
The wall goes up. Kennedy had a summit with Khrushchev that didn't go well in 61. He had the Bay of Pigs, then the wall went up. There was a kind of a crisis at the wall with tanks facing off against each other that October. That then eased And then the story ends. For most books, it kind of ends. I say, okay, then he went to Berlin in 63 and gave his Ich bin ein Berliner speech, and the wall came down 26 years later. End of story. So I think this bridge year of 1962 is incredibly important for both in the history of the escapes and the media and the White House, all in their relationship to this tension and demands for freedom and struggles for freedom, along the wall. So I think in that sense, the focus on 1962 here, I think, is vital. One other thing I'd add is when you mention declassified documents, the other half of it in the book, which some people may find more interesting, is that I got thousands of pages of documents out of the Stasi headquarters. The Stasi, of course, were the notorious East German secret police, whose monitoring activities even put the Gestapo to shame. Of course, when the wall fell, the East Germans took incredible steps to try to maintain the Stasi files, of which were tens of millions of documents on, probably one out of five citizens in the country. And many of the documents were shredded, but most of them remain. But they're just an incredible, millions and millions of files. So it's very difficult to get pertinent documents to whatever you're studying. But I was able to do it after, many, many months. And there's just incredible hair-raising, exclusive portions or quotes from these documents covering 1963, covering the Stasi informers who busted some of these tunnels, leading to arrests and deaths, Stasi interrogations of escapees and tunnel builders, all sorts of inside Stasi information that's never come out. So that's sort of the other half mm-hmm. of the declassified, you might say, a document trove that I got.
Maybe enough Stasi information for another book.
Well, I'd have to look at another year. The tunnels really peaked 62, right. 63, 64. I got a lot of material both from the Kennedy White House and from the Stasi that were not just on the tunnels, but got into other areas. I suppose I could spin off a related book, but I'm not sure that's in the works right now.
Were those files in German? How'd you handle that?
Yeah. Well, this book only came about because my daughter got her PhD and moved to Berlin with her husband. We went to visit her, first time we ever been to Berlin a few years ago. And I was just sort of overwhelmed by the wall story and learning about the escapes, learning about the tunnels. And so not only was she with her new PhD there in Berlin, actually living in the old East Berlin, but her husband is half German and is fluent in German. So he was able to go with me on, kind of amazingly, much to my surprise, I tracked down almost all the key tunnelers that were still alive, which was kind of amazing, in their late 70s and 80s, many of the escapees and other people. So he was able to go with me as an interpreter, and he was able to go through these all Stasi documents, all in German officialese, and translate them, pick out the most important things. So, without him, without my daughter there, I'm not sure how I would have been able to do this. I'm sure I'd still be working on it, and you'd mm-hmm. be interviewing me 3 years from now. Maybe.
Right. So I have a couple of other questions, and we're going to be running out of time here shortly. But one of them is the direction of the tunnels. Help our listeners understand which direction. They weren't actually digging toward freedom, were they?
Right. Well, because it was so risky to dig east to west, because you would have any tunnel you started in the east would probably draw attention from the Stasi and the police and so forth.
Sure.
And he had to get rid of the dirt and all this other stuff. So the vast majority of them went from west to east. Now, this goes against people's image. Most people's image of tunnels is always digging to freedom out of prisons or mm-hmm. POW camps or whatever. But these were almost all started by young West Germans. Many of them had already gotten out of the East at some point. They were almost all in their 20s, down to early 20s. And as you mentioned earlier, they were digging to bring out friends, lovers, family members, and, you know, and in some cases, just strangers. So they, even though they were already in the West in freedom, they risked their lives and certainly lost a lot of time, energy, digging these tunnels to the East in the hopes of that people would, you know, and the hopes had were long shot in many cases of bringing people out. So it was it's important to understand that part of it.
So tell us about Harry Seidel. He was one of the most effective tunnelers. And after you talk about him in those days, then you can also tell us that I guess he's one of the guys you met up with later in life.
Yeah. Well, he was a famous cyclist. Now, cycling was one of the major sports in Eastern Europe. So when I say he was one of the country's leading famous cyclists, that was kind of a big deal. But he was also became an anti-communist. And so he became he got to the West himself. And he got to be, in this period, probably the leading, most fearless, reckless tunnel digger. So I, in the book, I keep coming back to him. His exploits are, you know, quite incredible. However, at the end of this 1962, he went one step too far and himself was arrested and went to prison, became sort of an international hero, went to prison for 2 years. So he is someone I chronicle throughout the book as a kind of a wild man. But and yes, he's still living. There's something about the hardy Germans, I tell you. They all seem to get into their 80s and are in pretty good shape. So I was very fortunate for me.
So is this like the greatest generation? These guys came back from World War II and hardly spoke of it until you had to drag it out of them. Was that your experience?
That's true in many cases. Yeah. That's interesting you mentioned that. I mean, Harry Seidel himself, I had to try to get the questions to him because he hasn't spoke about this for all these decades. And that's true in many of the cases. So, I mean, it's true that in general, in Germany itself, you know, more has been written about escapes and tunnels, you know, than here, where virtually nothing has been written about. So some of these people have been in documentary films, written about here and there. But they're not exactly household names, and most of them have not gone out of their way to really talk about it. So it was quite lucky that I was able to reach most of them.
Well, good for you that you were able to do that. And I have to say, as I read this book, there are some parallels here, Greg. There's a wall now. There was a wall then. We've got a president then who was a little suspicious of the media, and we have one now who's really suspicious of the media. I think you've commented on some of these striking parallels.
Well, of course, there's the refugee question. People, even in Europe now, even in Germany now, tremendous questions about the refugees and whether how to help them. There are walls going up all over the world. I've chronicled that. You know, walls are a growth industry. So this question of what to do about refugees, what to do about the kind of what walls symbolize, even beyond what they actually accomplish, is certainly a hot topic, as is conflict with the media and where the media should stand on such things. Is it okay for the media to cover certain things, take certain steps, when it's in a good cause, when it's for, you know, back up American principles, or, you know, does the media really go too far and shouldn't do things like that? So there are numerous issues, you know, hot button issues today that, that I think the book comments on or evokes.
Well, Greg, thank you so much for writing the book, The Tunnels, Escapes Under the Berlin Wall and the Historic Films the JFK White House Tried to Kill, by Greg Mitchell. Thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Thank you for having me.
Next week, Matthew Palmer, author of the novel Enemy of the Good. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. If you missed some of our recent interviews, including my conversation with Samantha Silva about her novel Mr. Dickens and His Carol, you'll find them on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org, or download our free app from Google Play or the App Store to listen anytime, anywhere.